few people have the excitement of transiting from philosophy to a corporate world and then finally to become an author. A great commentator on public affairs, and such a person is our guest tonight, Gurcharan Das. Mr. Gurcharan Das, welcome.
Thank you.
So can we just begin with your life at the beginning, partition, the midnight children, as it were, coming to India, your family finding its feet in a partitioned India, etc. What was that experience, if you can recall it?
Yes, I was born in Lalpur. Lalpur, of course, is now called Faisalabad.
My Faisalabad, yes.
And so I begin in Lalpur, and at the age of 3, I'm given the name Ashok Kumar.
Really? So you were not Gurcharan Das, you were Ashok Kumar.
My grandmother suspected that my mother, her daughter-in-law, had given me that name because she thought my mother was secretly in love with a Bollywood actor.
Ashok Kumar.
Ashok,
of course.
At that time, everybody was in love with him.
Absolutely.
In the 1940s. And so she took me to her guru. And this was a family. He was a Sufi bhakti saint, this guru. And she placed me at his feet. And she said to the guru, Guruji anu nadyo. And he sees me at his feet and he says, well, let's call him Gurcharan Das. And so overnight, I'm transformed from the Prince of Happiness, Ashok Kumar, to the humble servant of the feet of the Guru.
Right.
And some years later, you know, I went to the Guru and I said, why did you give me that name? Ashok Kumar was such a nice name. He said, son, it's good to be reminded of humility. And then he gave me the best definition of humility it has stayed with me. And it was, take your work seriously, but not yourself seriously.
You were 13 years old when you arrived in the...
Yes. You know, I forgot to tell you one thing. You talked about partition, and I must tell you a story. This was in March 47. We are in Lahore. At the time, my father's an engineer and we live in Model Town. And suddenly we have to flee for our lives. And in that fleeing, we cross the border safely. We're waiting for a train at Jalandhar station and there's no timings. The train is late, of course, it's partition. And suddenly a train is coming in. There are sounds of bullets and the train doesn't stop. And after a few minutes, all of us turn to the window and there's a tall, handsome policeman. He's a Muslim. He's guarding the brilliant job, guarding the platform of peace. And two sick boys come from the back out of nowhere and they stab him. And all I remember is red blood after that falling. And the man falls down. And again, I looked at my mother, basically to ask, what the hell's going on? What happened? She has no explanation. My father keeps quiet. And that is the absurdity of life. That there was no reason for any of this to take place. This whole partition, futile, leading to deaths of millions of people. And ever since then, I've been suspicious of religion entering the public space.
Until tragically, we are still struggling with this.
Exactly. So you were asking me about the 13 years old.
You're 13 years old, you arrived in the United States, right?
Yes. So,
and your experiences there were not exactly very pleasant.
Well, I was, my father was, he had been working on Bhakra, and then he was picked to help the country with the negotiations which were taking place at the World Bank with Pakistan on the waters of the Indus, the Punjab rivers. And so I was put in a high school, Theodore Roosevelt High School. The principal looks at the color of my skin and he says, "Welcome to America, son. In our country, colored boys are not supposed to get too big for their boots. So you stay out of trouble for the next 4 years. You'll get a diploma. There are factories opening up in Maryland and Virginia. We were in Washington, D.C. And you'll get a good factory job. Welcome to the American dream." Instead of depressing me, I guess it charged me up. When I graduated at the top of my class. And I got scholarships to Harvard, Princeton, and Yale. And there was a report in the Washington Post with my picture on page 5. Something about a boy from India comes to make good or something like that. And the same principal calls me in and he forgets what had happened.
Forgets the color of your skin.
Exactly. Let me just say, Salman, that my peak moment in high school was when a girl from our class decided to have a birthday party. And she obviously had liberal parents. And so she invited black children and white children to her birthday party. And so we, after lots of eats, we sit down to play a game, which was very popular with American teenagers at the time, called Spin the Bottle. And the Spin the Bottle was about, you spun the bottle, and where the mouth of the bottle
pointed, yeah.
You could go and kiss the person of the opposite sex nearest where the mouth of the bottle was. But there was an unwritten rule that black boys were only supposed to kiss black girls and white boys were only supposed to kiss white girls. So when it came my turn, everybody was confused. What was this brownie going to do?
Right.
But I solved the problem instantly. The first turn, it was a black girl. I kissed her right in the mouth. And second turn, it was a white girl. I kissed her right in the kisser. And so I kept getting bonus turns. And I kept kissing girls all evening long. And that was the best moment in my high school.
Oh, I can imagine. That's be difficult to forget. But tell me, just take you away from the U.S. for a while. Let's get you to Russia. Our RT viewers would be very interested in knowing what your Russian connections have been. And I understand that from your days at school and college, you had a great discovery of Russian literature. What was that?
You know, the link with Russia really takes place at Harvard. I arrived there like a good Punjabi middle-class boy. My mother telling me at the airport before I left, she says with tears in her eyes, "Now you go to Harvard and study something useful. Why don't you be like your father, engineer? Engineers will get a job in India." So dutifully, I write engineering as my major when I arrive. But I have a roommate who's studying Russian literature.
Mm-hmm.
And he's reading Anna Karenina of Tolstoy. So one day at lunch, he says, "Gurcharan, you know, when you grow up, and if you fall in love with a woman, make sure she's someone like Anna Karenina." And then he starts to catalog the virtues of Anna Karenina. And he says, whether you marry her or you have an affair with her, that's not important. But she should be like Anna Karenina. Anna Karenina, as you know, has this very sad affair, or actually a very happy affair, which ends badly. While he's cataloging Anna Karenina's virtues in the words of Leo Tolstoy, I'm thinking something is wrong. here I'm calculating pipe friction and mugging up Bernoulli's equations, and this guy's dreaming of sleeping with Anna Karenina. Something is wrong. And so I go charging off to the dean's office in a few weeks, and I strike out engineering, and I write down liberal arts. And so it was Russian literature, which I then went on to study, by the way. So the Russian connection, to tell you, is a lifelong connection, because I have been more influenced by Russian literature. My favorite author is Chekhov. And that's what got me to write my first play. That was the inspiration.
All right. So the third play was Nine Jakku Hill. Yeah. All right. I haven't seen that one, unfortunately.
Well, you know, it had the largest number of performances in Delhi. It was deeply, deeply influenced by Chekhov. And so what I'm saying, for me, Russia lives in literature, from Pushkin.
Oh, well, I mean, of course, there's undoubtedly, when you think of literature, you think of them. Come to your career in philosophy. You got a scholarship to go to Oxford for a PhD, for a defense.
Yes. And then I'm sitting home one day between Harvard and Oxford that summer of 63. And I asked myself on the bench in the park I'm sitting, and I ask, do I really want to spend the rest of my life at that stratosphere of abstract thought? No, I want a life of action. And so I quietly write off to Oxford to say, I'm not coming. And they were polite enough to say, well, you know, if you change your mind, get in touch. And
you never did.
So I never did. And so I start looking at ads, and I have no clue what this life of action is all about that I want, but I do feel I've got to do something now. I saw an ad in the paper and I answered it, and so they hired me as a trainee. I had no clue what a trainee was, but I had to go shop to shop selling Vicks. Aaj ek dozen ek free. Kitna mangta hai? And so I started a new life.
But you then, at 50, decided to quit. You said, this new life is good enough, but there is something more to do. And then at 50, you decided to become a writer, to become an author. Is that right?
That's correct. The reality is that in 91, I really felt very good. But by then, the company had been, I was sent to the world headquarters of the company, and it's suddenly 1994 when I'm there at the world headquarters, and I'm driving to work, and I turn on the radio, NPR, National Public Radio, and there's an interview which says that the Congress Party has turned against Narasimha Rao, and the left wing of the Congress Party has become stronger than before. And frankly, the commentator says there's a real fear about the reforms being reversed. And I really got scared. And for me, everything good had happened after 91. Luckily, I had met Manmohan Singh when he was a nobody in the finance ministry. He had just joined and as a kind of advisor, etc. He wasn't powerful or anything, but we struck off. And he was a kindly man. And then he became finance minister. When I shot off a telegram to him, not expecting any reply, and in the telegram I said, look, how come no one's selling the reforms? I believe they might get reversed. And I didn't expect him to reply. But he replied back. And he says, you come back. And come back and sell the reforms. By then, I'd been writing some op-eds. But I didn't expect it. So I went and told my wife. And by then also, I had begun to question whether selling an extra case of Pampers or Tide detergent or Vicks or Oil of Olay or Gillette blades, all good products, but is this what life is all about? And so, no. My wife was a good sport, but she said, but where are we going to get the salary from next month? And I said, we have enough savings. Luckily, we had bought a house before we had left. And so we had a home to come to. And that's how I landed here. And that's how I started writing. I got a column in the Times of India after a few years. And the columns, etc., and my travels around India resulted in India Unbound.
All right. Terrific. So if I take you back to India Unbound, it obviously had, it had a message and it had a backdrop. Where are we now with being bound or being unbound?
First, the good news. The good news that ever since 1991, and now that's 30 years, our country has grown at 6.4% per year, which for a democracy, and this is in real terms, net of inflation, for a democracy, that's damn good, almost unprecedented. We have lifted 450 million people out of poverty, not as much as China, but still pretty good. The middle class has grown from 10% to 30%. But we have not created the jobs that 6.4% should have created. And why? Because we have still not created an industrial revolution. Every country that went from poverty to prosperity since the British Industrial Revolution 200 years ago did it by going from an agricultural surplus to industry and then to a digital knowledge economy. We seem to have skipped. We went from a green revolution to an IT revolution and we skipped the missing. So there's the missing middle. The manufacturing only employs 11% of the people. GDP, only 15% of the GDP. Looking forward, I'm glad we have this Viksit Bharat goal. Countries should have ambitions and goals. This goal would require us to move at 8% plus when we've done 6.4. I believe that today the preconditions for moving up to an industrial revolution are far better than they were in 91. We have far better infrastructure. The road mileage has doubled since 2011. We have created a digital revolution. That's taken out a lot. I mean, bank from 42%, 88% of people have bank accounts. And we have GST has made our country one country. So a lot of good things are there, but Salman, we are still the most over-regulated country in the world. Now, the good news is that we have realized this thanks to Mr. Trump. And we have not only are we signing up with the EU and the UK, the FTAs, it shows that we are, and the EU understanding with the US, that we are going to reduce our protectionism. We are going to open ourselves more to the world. And these three deregulation commissions that have been set up, these high-level deregulation under the cabinet secretary, former and the present, they really promise to do something. So, bottom line, I'm optimistic. I think if we can go from 6.4 to 7.5, that's all we need to do. So, go to 7.5. It'll take us to 12,000 per capita income will go from 2,800 today to 12,500. I think at that point, we'll be home free. The majority of our population, of our people, will be a middle class on Indian terms, meaning not car-owning middle class.
Right.
But they with a life of some ease and less anxiety on the economic front. And that's good enough.
That's terrific. Now, just because we are an international audience, and a lot of people are concerned these days about what's happening in West Asia. And the crisis is obviously a crisis that engulfs everybody, and certainly the Indian economy as well. So do you have any views on that?
I do. You know, I'm editing for Penguin, a 15-volume economic history, business history of India. And I learned from the latest. There's a chap called Mahmood Kuria, who is writing a book on the Indian Ocean. Mm-hmm. Indian Ocean was called Mar Liberum, which means a free sea, until the Portuguese, in 1507, a Portuguese admiral, Alfonso Albuquerque, invades Hormuz, and he sets up a toll station, and they start charging toll for the first time. That free sea has become unfree. And 517 years later, another chap called Donald Trump, President of the United States, invades Hormuz and creates a blockade. What the West Asian crisis shows to us is really the unraveling of the American order. Now, I'm unlike a lot of people, I'm not an America basher, but I do feel that that order in the last 60 years, 80 years, lifted a billion people from India and China alone. And it has done a lot, it did a lot of good, created this globalization and really improved the world for good. But it's unraveling. And maybe it's time. But this is not a good time. Trump is just in a line of autocrats. Only this chap's unhinged. And he's a narcissist. And we played him badly over Sindoor, I believe. As far as Sindoor, Operation Sindoor and West Asia crisis is concerned, bottom line, it is underlining the unraveling of the second great liberal order in the world.
You're seen as a unique category of public intellectuals. People describe you as a liberal. Some people say you are a lonely liberal. Some others have decided to give you an award. Think there's a global international award where you're called a libertarian, etc. But if you were asked to describe yourself in terms of liberty, libertarianism, where would you place yourself?
Well, I would place myself right in the middle. And I would place myself because the bloody leftists have taken over the word liberal. So they're called left liberals. And the people to the right are the libertarians who believe in a minimalist chokidar state.
The Thatcher model, etc.
That's right. Yeah. The midnight watchman.
Right.
And I believe that the state still is responsible for education, for health, for a safety net for the poorest. So I don't belong there, and I don't belong here. So I'm in the middle, and that's a lonely place, Salman, because if you write something in favor of I think we can learn from both sides. From the left, we can learn. We can be reminded that they are poor in the world. And it's always good to be reminded about the poor. And second, on the right, they remind you about community, the importance of community, which we liberals forgot. And we've never thought of ourselves. We've kind of been on our own. Liberals have, and we've downplayed that part. And in a sense, you know, the rise of Hindutva is a cry for community, because for the first 40, 50 years of our 50, 60 years of our life as a nation, people like us, PLUs, have ruled it. Brown Sahibs We stepped into the shoes of the white sahibs when they left, both in the private sector and public sector. And we have ruled the roost. And frankly, in a country, 80 years after, only 15% of Indians, we've operated in English. And if you are a bright young person today, you arrive in a meeting where they're discussing strategy or anything serious, it's in English. And that person doesn't know English. He feels deaf in his own country. Imagine the tragedy of that. So I'm not saying Hindi should be a national language. I think we've handled it far better than our neighbors have, Sri Lanka or Pakistan. The reality, though, is that I think Hindutva, much as I oppose bringing religion into politics, but it was a kind of cry for community, which I feel the 85% of Indians who do not speak English, and yet they see around them all the rewards have been monopolized by this 5% or 1% of Indians. I can understand that. You know, unfortunately, Gandhi died too early after independence, because he was able to reach out to the ordinary, to the masses, and he could give the language of our constitution of liberty and equality in the language of dharma. And in that language of dharma, he would appeal to the people against untouchability and the importance of satyagraha and freedom and all that, self-rule. So no one after that has sold the constitution to the people. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I am. It's a lonely place, because if I write something positive about the right, the leftists, I lose all my leftist friends. If I write something positive about the left, I lose all my leftist friends. So it's a lonely place to be.
But you know that we seek you out, despite the fact that you say you're in a lonely place. There are people here who seek you out, as we did seek you out as well, because we believe that what you have done and what you are continuing to think about this country is of great significance. And perhaps it's that middle path that we all need to take ultimately that will get us to our destination.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this very, very exciting conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.